May it please the court. Prosecutors have a duty that's distinct among attorneys, and that duty is to do justice in a fair manner. That duty was violated in this case when the state used Mr. Walter's mugshot as a rhetorical ploy to establish his guilt. And that duty continues to be violated by the state's refusal to admit that doing that was in any way improper. And there can be no doubt that that was wrong. Every case that specifically looked at the issue has arrived at the conclusion that it is wrong. And just the general principles of it as well make it incorrect. I realize that issue has never come up in Missouri courts before, but just the general notion that the closing argument has to be relevant and not designed to inflame the passions of the jury. And that's clearly what happened here when at the very end of the state's closing argument, it throws up his mugshot and then slaps guilty across it. I mean, there's no legitimate legal purpose for doing that, except for showing this guy looks guilty, he's guilty.
The Court of Appeals agreed that that was improper, but found it was not prejudicial.
Yes.
Can you address that?
Yes. And, you know, as I'm preserved, we have to show it rises to the level of manifest injustice. And I think going to that, there's really three distinct things. One is just...
Well, wasn't it raised in the motion for new trial?
It was, but...
Then why isn't it preserved?
Mr. Veets' objection was not timely made at point of trial. It appears from the record that, and I from his Western District Parole argument, he essentially conceded this, which was it was displayed during trial.
But can you tell from the trial court's judgment whether or not the trial court considered it, even though there wasn't a timely objection?
Yeah, the trial court did consider it.
Well, why wouldn't the trial judge be in a better position to determine whether there was prejudice as a result of this action, irrespective of whether it's plain error or preserved? But certainly the trial court, the reason we have a preservation issue, right, is so that we know and have confidence that the trial judge, whose boots on the ground, had a better opportunity to evaluate and rule on it, right?
Yes.
And so we know that even though there wasn't a timely objection, at least in this case, that the trial judge did consider it in the motion for new trial.
Yes. Well, and we would fully accept and encourage the court to review it, not under plain error, but just under preserved error. I mean, we would, of course, be perfectly happy with that. But arguing kind of as it is, so obviously we can hit the plain error standard, we can hit the preserved error standard. And just hitting its actual effect on the jury, one thing is that you look at cases in which defendants were required to wear prison garb as defendants at a trial. And the U.S. Supreme Court said that brands them. That brands those defendants with the unmistakable mark of guilt. And that's exactly what happens with that picture. I mean, he's in his prison jumpsuit. It's a mugshot. He's branded as being guilty. And then on top of that, there's both that figurative branding, but then in this case, there's a literal branding where the state slaps guilty right on it.
I think most people could agree it's improper comment, but how did it have a decisive effect on the verdict when there was overwhelming weight of evidence against this man?
Well, and I guess I would put a little bit with the notion of overwhelming evidence. There was evidence contrary to the notion that he had the intent to do this. And so in looking at this, right, the court is not measuring prejudice based on evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict. In assessing prejudice, the court has to consider all the evidence. And part of that is, I think, taking the prosecutor essentially at the prosecutor's word in presenting this argument to the jury. The prosecutor designed this argument to have an effect on this jury. This was the last thing in its slideshow. This was specifically designed by the prosecutor. You know, this was its finale, to have that effect. And this court should effectively kind of honor that and take the prosecutor at his word on that.
Well, can you remind us what the defense's evidence was? Was a lot of it relating to his credibility, where he claimed he wasn't aware of the crime? So you're saying that this might have made a difference. You think it wasn't overwhelming because of that? Because his... belief in him played a part in the jury's decision, belief in his version of events?
Right. There is positive evidence out there presented by the jury going directly to the issue of his intent. It's his girlfriend came in and testified that he did not know of her plan to make methamphetamine. His mother came in and testified to his history of sinus issues. It would make sense if he was purchasing items with pseudoephedrine.
What was the evidence? Part of their evidence is the suspicious activity in buying multiple things within a very short period of time, going to Walmart,
yes.
going somewhere else, going back to Walmart. What evidence is there of his involvement in that buying pattern?
He bought one, and I forget exactly how much it was, but essentially one pack of items containing pseudoephedrine. Then he drove over there, and they split up in the store.
And was there evidence that he had a sinus infection, a chronic one, and so he used that regularly?
Yes, his mother testified as to his chronic sinus infection.
Was there evidence, though, that, and I can't remember whether there were security videos or...
Yes.
But was there evidence that he participated in buying lithium batteries somewhere else or the pseudoephedrine in other stores or just her involvement?
No, my recollection is he only bought the one pack of pseudoephedrine. He drove her, and she was the one who bought the lithium batteries. And on the issue of prejudice, though, I think this court has a broader responsibility here, in addition to just gauging, specifically the evidence and the impact of this, which is. There's, certainly in banks, this court focuses on this notion of deterrence, that prosecutors do these things, and maybe they kind of get a slap on the wrist from the Court of Appeals in a concurring or dissenting opinion, but they never find prejudice. And so what's the risk to a prosecutor? And the lack of finding prejudice and the lack of overturning these cases kind of emboldens prosecutors into doing this, and there's no real check on them, except for maybe some kind of public shaming, but it doesn't reverse the case. And
if we did reverse the case, it would go back to the trial court with the overwhelming evidence, if it still exists, that they could convict him again. If they have the overwhelming evidence, they don't really need the person in a jumpsuit and with the guilt on his forehead. I remember the case at Deck when we, as a court, we unanimously, 7-0 on Deck, said it's okay to have shackles on the defendant at trial. But as luck would have it, 9-0 from this other Supreme Court, they said, no, you can't have shackles. Who's to tell? I mean, how do you police this kind of thing if you don't do anything? And if you don't, if the evidence is overwhelming, they could try him again and win.
And if it's not overwhelming, then perhaps he'll be acquitted.
Right. And there is evidence here that a jury could believe he's not guilty of it. And that's kind of what the whole system is about. He has a right to a trial, and he has a right to a fair trial.
Other than the evidence of him buying the drugs, what other evidence was there that it was the location of the Red Bull under the hood of his truck? Was there disputed evidence as to the jean shorts with the syringe in the pocket, as to whether those were his size or not his size?
Yes, yeah, so my client's 32 waist, and the jean shorts were 36. And there was evidence that those jean shorts with the syringe likely belonged to a man who was diabetic. And I just note that the syringe was never tested for any kind of methamphetamine residue. They don't know what it was used for.
And what about the Red Bull and the shed where it was found in the truck? Who does that belong to? What was the evidence about it?
Well, it's his truck, but there's no notion of exactly when the Red Bull was placed there. It was certainly suggested by the defendant's evidence that it was Shane Nicholson who put it there.
And who is that?
That was a man who Miss Martinson, who is Mr. Walter's girlfriend, testified was at the house and was helping her make methamphetamine.
And he was the gentleman with the cell phone, is that right?
Yes. Yes. And I think part of the prejudice in this case as well is the very deliberate nature of what occurred here. If we look back, for instance, at this court's decision in Banks, that argument was made in rebuttal. Which I think it's fair to say. I mean, there was certainly a little bit of pre-planning, but it wasn't you know, it likely wasn't something the state had worked on and created. You know, it was in the moment, in the heat of trial, that they made this decision to call him the devil and invoke devil, God, angels, all that kind of stuff. Here, you have it on a PowerPoint presentation.
Can I ask you about the photograph,
yes.
Mugshot? It was talked about during the course of the trial. Was it ever displayed to the jury before the closing argument?
No, it was not. It was entered into evidence as part of a packet of just jail records. And yeah, the trial court makes a comment about it, where we've all gotten out of the habit of showing the other side the exhibits and showing the court the exhibits as well. And you know, Mr. Veets, defense counsel, says obviously if he would have seen that picture in there, he would have objected to it.
I mean, if it's in, though, it's in for all purposes, right?
No, it's not.
If an exhibit is offered, if you offer a stack like that, there's no objection. Why isn't it in for all purposes? I understand the guilty wasn't stamped over the
right.
one, but why isn't the mugshot in for all purposes?
And it's, there's improper purposes you can use evidence for.
Well, then why can't you make a limited injection? I mean, that's the part I don't understand about that argument. I mean, if it's in, it's in for everything. Or you have an obligation to object and force to take pages out or make a limited offer?
Well, I mean, it's in to the extent that, I mean, right, it's just, it's in evidence. If they wanted to hand it to the jury, and potentially at that point, if Mr. Veets would have seen it, he could have objected, tried to get it out at that point, maybe some discussion.
You're saying there was no prejudice from it simply being in a box, but and the first time it was shown to the jury was in closing.
Correct. And it's, I mean, it's used for an improper purpose in closing, which is you're saying this guy, I mean, that's about the guiltiest picture you can have of someone is a mugshot. And you're saying, look at him, he's guilty.
Well, it's not just most mugshots, the person is wearing street clothing, is that right?
I don't know about kind of most mugshots, but I mean, certainly here he was
all in. All those ones are celebrities there.
Yeah. And luckily Mr. Walters was shaved bald, so there wasn't the messy hair. But you do have the,
he
I
was,
mean,
in,
it
a,
is
he
the
was in a prison jumpsuit here.
Yeah, and it's unmistakable, and you've got the numbers on the back. And I mean, I would relate it to if we had a case where a guy was in prison guard, sitting there throughout the trial in prison guard, and the state got up there, and I'm sorry, I'm out of time if I could. Got up there and said, look at him in his jumpsuit, he's guilty. And there's absolutely no way that would be appropriate, and there's no way it's appropriate here. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
May it please the court. The prosecutor may argue that the defendant is guilty if it appears that that argument is coming from the evidence as opposed to from information outside the record. That's the line that must be towed. And if that line, if there's any question that that line has been crossed, then the trial court has the right to expect that the alleged impropriety be brought forward and argued before the jury returns its verdict.
Was there any question of whether it was observed by defense counsel at the time it was shown on the PowerPoint?
I think it's undisputed that defense counsel and the court did not see it.
So when was it brought to their attention?
It had
because
to have been during...
Because the reason I ask that is you're saying they should have objected to it at the time it occurred, but if it was not observed, when should they have objected?
At the earliest possible opportunity. And the jury deliberated in this case for over 2 hours. And we know that defense counsel knew about the alleged impropriety during deliberations because as soon as the verdict was announced, he brought it to the court's attention.
But once they start deliberation, then you have lost the opportunity for the objection to have any impact, because normally you'd have an objection, the court then could determine whether some curative instruction was required. Once they're in the middle of deliberations, you don't have that ability. If you bring them back in and tell them not to consider it, you're emphasizing that evidence. So doesn't that excuse preservation?
I disagree. You have lost the ability to cure any alleged error, but you do have the right to request a mistrial. And if that had been done here, I suspect that the trial court would have said, well, counsel, I'll give you your option. Do you want a mistrial or do you want to see what the jury
says? Well, what's the difference between asking for a mistrial during deliberation and right after deliberation?
Because
in terms of preservation.
Because you know the results of the verdict at that point. So you wait to see if you get the benefit of the jury's verdict or the benefit of your objection. That is what's been described as gambling on the verdict, and there's no case law out there that says a trial court has to honor that gamble.
But are there cases that have similar facts where the objectionable material wasn't discovered until during deliberation?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
So there aren't cases that have found that that's a sandbagging or improper gambling on the deliberation?
I mean, I think the facts of this case are sui generis, but there are plenty of cases saying that you have to bring it to the trial court's attention at the earliest possible time.
What's the record regarding this? Are you suggesting that neither the judge nor the defense lawyer saw the picture during the PowerPoint presentation?
That's what they said on the record, yes, Your Honor.
So because the defense counsel was watching the prosecutor make the argument, not turned watching the PowerPoint.
That's what he said, yes.
And the judge also?
Correct.
Isn't it a little sneaky? I mean, I'm sure the prosecutor saw the PowerPoint before they put it before the jury, they produced it. I mean, not knowing that this is a problem, and the judge and the defense attorney not seeing it, didn't it seem a little bit problematic to the prosecution?
There's no evidence that he was being sneaky. There's no evidence as to where the PowerPoint was being displayed. I think that the court...
Who created the PowerPoint?
Pardon?
Who created the PowerPoint?
The prosecutor.
Well, okay. And PowerPoint's being created to show to the jury, is it not?
Yes. But he's not using anything in there other than argument and evidence, and that's what the prosecutor...
Well, wait a minute, time out. If he'd have displayed the mugshot without the guilty across it, I could understand that argument. Wasn't the piece of evidence that was in evidence altered or modified by self-imposing?
I don't think it was altered or modified, and this is an important point that I want to emphasize. There seems to be some confusion, at least in the Court of Appeals opinion, as to how the mugshot was first displayed. From the record at page 490, 6 through 12, the prosecutor explains how he did it. He put the mugshot up first without the writing on it, and then wrote on it. So it's not as if he put it before the jury for the first time with the guilty verdict on it. It was clear that he was making this argument. It's just as if he pointed to him and said, he's guilty. I'm writing guilty on this photo.
You know, in the case from Washington, it was almost like it's the same prosecutor, because the same thing was done, which is two different states at different times, the same thing. Is this, you know, when I was a young prosecutor, I mean, you go to trial school and they teach you techniques, okay? Defense attorneys do it too. Is this something, this PowerPoint is something that's being learned or taught?
Not in my trial school.
Point in time?
No, Your Honor. I have never seen this taught at trial school or anything like that.
So are you saying this is improper?
I'm saying that, no. I'm saying that if you put the photograph up there and then wrote on it, then that is an argument that the defendant is guilty, which is proper if it's clear that you're talking about the evidence.
So you would recommend, if you were teaching trial school, that prosecutors use this, because there's nothing wrong with it.
There's a difference between saying that it's not improper and saying that I think it's a good idea. I could put up the judgment behind me today and write affirmed on it, but I think that would be not improper, but not a good strategy. So I would not recommend
it. But does that tie into, if we disagree with you, does that really support the argument made by opposing counsel that you know, just saying, oh gosh, you shouldn't have done this, really isn't going to have any effect, that it's just a slap on the wrist, and that in order to deter misconduct, we really have to reverse a conviction, because otherwise people are just going to say, you know, you can push the line, you can do something that many people would find distasteful, but you're never going to get reversed for it.
A couple of points. One you refer to as misconduct as opposed to error. So I think at best we have prosecutorial error here. I don't think this comes to the level of misconduct. The Court of Appeals didn't find that either. However, the defendants have said that in their briefing, and I think that that's going too far. Second of all, I don't think that the Court of Appeals' opinion is just a slap on the wrist. It pretty much announces that it was error, and if this court wants to go that route, that's fine, because I think the Court of Appeals got it right with respect to the prejudice analysis.
And why? Why is this overwhelming evidence? It seems to me this isn't a case where you just have one-sided evidence. Certainly, there's two different questions here and two different questions being briefed. One is there enough evidence to support the conviction? But the other is, he has an explanation. He has a story which, if believed,
would not make him liable for the crime of which he was charged and for which it turned out he was convicted. He had an explanation that he didn't buy most of the ingredients there. He didn't know how to make the meth. He didn't have some key ingredients there. He didn't put the bowl there. He acted surprised when he saw it. Now, the jury may say, I don't believe any of that, and I think you're guilty. But in light of that, what you call overwhelming evidence, but I'm unclear, it wasn't just one-sided. There was evidence on both sides. Why wouldn't this kind of thing have made a difference, or might have made a difference? How can we say it wouldn't?
Well, I disagree that the evidence was not overwhelming. The evidence is undisputed that the defendant and Ms. Martinson went into town and bought the component parts of methamphetamine.
But his evidence was that Ms. Martinson did. The only thing he personally purchased was one prescription for one set of pseudonephrine, and he had a sinus infection. Is that correct, or am I misunderstanding the evidence?
Misunderstanding it in part. Okay. First of all, he didn't testify at all, so his credibility wasn't on the line here, as was discussed on the case before. Second of all, the evidence was that he went with Ms. Martinson and made two purchases, not just one. Two purchases, one at 4 o'clock and one at 4:08. So he went and bought pseudoephedrine at one place at 4 o'clock, went back to another place and bought it at 4:08.
Okay.
So two different times. And she bought the rest of the component parts in four separate purchases.
Okay.
And then it is undisputed that the very items that he had purchased were used to make methamphetamine. That's undisputed. That was his evidence. His girlfriend testified to that. So it's undisputed that he bought the component parts of methamphetamine in this manner, in a suspicious manner, and it's undisputed that those component parts were in fact used. Then he called his friend, and his friend asked, "Is it fire?" To which he said, "Yes."
Which you interpret as being virtually an admission he's making methamphetamine, but that's really that could be the interpretation, but that's not something that is commonly known, is it? It took the trooper saying, well, folks in the community, there's no evidence that he knew that fire was a good batch of methamphetamine.
The only evidence on the point was that that is what is understood in that community to mean what fire means.
So the jury could disbelieve that.
Well, the jury is entitled to disbelieve anything, but there's no evidence to the contrary showing that it means something else.
And they don't have to have evidence to the contrary to disbelieve it.
Correct.
But here, unusually, you have the girlfriend coming in and saying, I admitted I was making this batch, but I did it without his knowledge, and this was all my stuff. And there was somebody else who came in and helped me, and he's the one who put the bowl in the truck and who maybe who the pants belonged to. I know there was evidence as to who the pants and syringe belonged to, someone else. So there was a contrary story there, too, whether or not he testified. And it was up to the jury to weigh and balance that and make determination as to whether he was guilty or not.
That's correct, but the evidence...
That's unlike in all the other... I understand why you think you made a submissible case, but this seems unlike the cases where we've held the evidence is overwhelming.
I just think it's implausible that he was down there in that basement with all of the component parts surrounding him, all the paraphernalia surrounding him, with the strong smell emanating from the drugs and everywhere else in that basement and to disclaim knowledge of it. And when he was confronted with the contents of the bowl, he recognized them as methamphetamine and said, you've set me up.
You're kind of in a horns of dilemma in that if you argue the evidence is overwhelming and that the photo with the guilt, whatever, is not prejudicial, then you could retry him and do it without the photo. However, if you say the evidence isn't overwhelming, if it's shown that the evidence isn't overwhelming and you're buttressing it with this photo, then it may be more reversible that way. So you're kind of in a difficult position, as you know.
Right. I think it has to help me that the evidence is overwhelming. Otherwise, we're getting rid of plain error review. If you say that if there's error and the evidence is overwhelming, that doesn't help you, then we're getting rid of the entire manifest injustice prong of
plain
error
review.
On this
case, we're dealing with the facts of this case, though.
Right, but...
What's your response to my question about whether or not it's really plain error? What rule are you relying on? Because if they never saw it, if the defense lawyer never saw it, and plain error is something that's open, obvious, and clear to the trial judge.
Right.
The trial judge told us he didn't see it. So how was it open, obvious, and clear to the trial judge? So the first time the trial judge had the opportunity to review it was in the post-trial motion.
Correct.
Okay. So why is it really plain error? I don't understand why this case isn't preserved there.
In order to have preserved error, you have to make a contemporaneous objection during closing argument.
I understand that. And plain error is something that's open, obvious, and clear to the trial judge.
Correct.
So if it wasn't open, obvious, and clear because the trial judge said he didn't see it, the first opportunity that the trial judge had the ability to evaluate it was in the motion after trial.
Right. And the trial judge saw all the evidence.
Right. And he ruled on this issue.
Correct.
So it isn't plain here because we know the trial judge ruled on it.
Yes, the trial judge did rule on it, yes.
Okay, so if the trial judge ruled on it, and the trial judge thought that that was the first opportunity that it had to rule on it, why do you suggest that we're to review this under the plain error standard?
For one thing, that the point on appeal argues it that way.
I understand.
And I had an opportunity to brief the issue of whether this is...
That's why I've asked both of you the same question.
My understanding of plain error review is It applies to errors that could have been made during trial. This was made after trial. And so I don't think it survives plain error review for one of the reasons that Your Honor just mentioned, that it wasn't plain, open, and obvious.
But I think the point of the question is, and I'm not sure I've seen a case on it, so it's not that if you don't find one, if you're not aware of one, that's I certainly understand. But this is sort of unique in that neither the judge nor counsel saw this until after the jury was already deliberating, and in that situation, was it your obligation to raise it before it went to the jury, or in that kind of situation where neither the judge nor counsel saw it till after, why wasn't their obligation to only raise it once they learned of it, which was after the jury began deliberating? So wasn't it a timely objection? Because you can't be held not to have made something timely when you weren't aware of it and when you reasonably were unaware of it earlier.
But I disagree that he was unaware of it during deliberations. It's an easy thing.
But prior to deliberations, prior to submission.
I'm not contesting his word that he didn't see it until the jury was deliberating.
Go ahead.
But while the jury was deliberating, the defense counsel obviously became aware of it because he brought it up as soon as it developed.
And that's where Judge Breckenridge asked you, is there any case that says if you become aware of something during deliberation, you waive it if you wait till after the trial to bring it to the court's attention?
Not specifically on that point, but I think the general principle of not gambling on the verdict applies here. Because you can bring it to the judge's attention, and the judge can give you the option of a mistrial or seeing what the jury does. It's not fair to say, well, if I get the benefit of the verdict, then we all go home, and this never becomes an issue. If I did get a bad result, then I have a really good appellate issue.
Do we know when or how the counsel became aware of it?
We do not. The record does not reflect it.
Sorry. Thank you.
What makes you think that the trial judge was any more likely to grant a mistrial than a new trial based upon the same allegation of error?
A mistrial as opposed to a new trial?
No, you're suggesting that if it would have been brought to the trial court's attention before the verdict came in, that the trial court would have sustained the motion for
Could have sustained a motion for a new mistrial or a new trial.
Yeah. Is there anything in the trial court's judgment that suggested that the timing of this objection factored into its ruling?
No, Your Honor. All accounts say that the judge was able to review what this evidence was. The judge was able to review the evidence, he heard it in the trial, and was able to weigh those two together and reach the appropriate decision in this case.
Is there any evidence in the record regarding when the defense counsel became aware of the photo with guilty being shown to the jury?
No, there's not, apart from the fact that we know that he knew about it before as the jury was returning his verdict, because he brought it up immediately after. There wasn't a break in between the jury's verdict and his raising it to the trial judge.
Thank you very much for your argument.
May it please the court.
Is there anything in the record that suggests that the defense counsel or the court were blocked from seeing it, or were they just looking somewhere else?
I know that they were, in fact, looking somewhere else. They were both looking at the jury.
So they could have seen it had they been looking.
Well, I don't know. I believe defense counsel, I'm not exactly sure of the makeup, but I believe essentially jury box here, screen here, judge here, defense counsel here. And so, I mean, if they would have gotten it, I mean, it was either looking at the jury and the prosecutor or looking at the screen, is my understanding from the record. And so, yeah, I mean, if they would have made an effort, they certainly, I think, both could have seen.
But you're saying they couldn't have both been looking at the PowerPoint and looking at the jury and the prosecutor at the same time, so they would have had to choose one or the other.
That's my understanding. And you know, there's, in addition to showing people evidence, you know, that you're going to admit, I mean, there's another practice that's an excellent practice that you see by a lot of very good trial attorneys, which is if you know you're going to do something objectionable, you put it in front of the court and you put it in front of the other counsel beforehand so you don't run into a situation like this where it has essentially been, you know, it was snuck in as part of jail records with no notion by anybody that there was a picture in there, and then it's presented without anybody being able to see it. And
well, I think Judge Wilson just pointed out they were able to see it. They just did not see it.
Yes.
There's not a whole lot in this record to suggest that either side of this case was using best practices throughout it. Would you agree with that?
I'd agree with that. And you know, the state brought up another issue, which is this distinction between prosecutorial misconduct and prosecutorial error. And I can say I like that distinction because a lot of times what prosecutors do, it's not flagrant misconduct. It's a mistake, and we all make mistakes. But this was misconduct. This was taking his mugshot and specifically using it to show he's guilty. And under no construction of appropriate evidence and appropriate argument is that okay. It's just not okay, and that's misconduct. On the issue of overwhelming evidence in this case, anytime you're dealing with joint possession, which you have here, as well as constructive possession, which you also have here, because these items were spread all around the house, you're going to have... I mean, arguments, certainly, with respect to whether this person knew about this, knew what was going on, and all that. And there's a quote that I love from a Western District case, and I forget the case, but the quote is, choice in bad friends is not a crime. And, certainly, Mr. Walters is hanging around with people who are making meth, using meth. And I think we can all agree that's kind of a bad idea, but just that by itself is not a crime. And the state has to prove that he was the one doing it. And with those notions of joint possession and constructive possession, I don't think we hit the overwhelming evidence in this case that precludes plain error. And I'm out of time.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.